Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. We have a very enjoyable one today. You know, for once, Bob Odenkirk is my guest. Bob, of course, the star of the drama Better Call Saul, which is about to start its sixth and final season now on AMC. Also, you can get all the previous seasons on Netflix starting, I think, now. And Bob has been playing Saul Goodman now for 13 years, first on Breaking Bad. This year, Bob tells us Better Call Saul is going to be thoroughly intertwined with Breaking Bad. So this season is going to be a doozy. Bob has written a memoir, which is terrific. The title, Comedy, 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 Drama, and that title captures the arc of Bob's career. I've known Bob for, I think, 34, 35 years when he started working on SNL. I'm thinking that's 1987. And Bob, like I, started writing comedy in grade school. That's not that unusual. Now, I remember when I was at SNL, and actually to this day, I have acquaintances, friends, donors who come to me and say, my nephew or niece wants to be a comedy writer. I was wondering if you could meet with him or her and talk with her about that. And I'd say, sure. And too often when I ask them, are you writing comedy? They will say no. I years ago, I had one kid, when I asked him this, said, oh, I don't have time. I'm on the Columbia varsity basketball team. And I said, let's say I was Magic Johnson and you came to me and said you wanted to be a pro basketball player. And I ask you, are you playing basketball? And you said, no, I'm just too busy doing stand-up comedy. So anyway, Bob grew up near Chicago, loved writing, loved comedy. But like a lot of us, he didn't know anybody who actually was in show business. But he's ended up having one of the most fascinating, continues to have one of the most fascinating careers. And it all comes down to loving this work and from his willingness to go wherever it takes him. And you're really, really going to love this podcast, you know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
So, I love the book. Love the book. You talk about so much stuff that I relate to. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is that you started writing comedy really early.
Yeah.
And it was your ambition to be a comedy writer. Well, it wasn't. You didn't actually then think there was such a path for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know how you experienced your journey to finding that career. But, you know, it's that Midwestern thing of like, you know, human beings don't do show business. I've never met anyone.
We didn't know anybody.
I mean, you don't even think about it. It's even saying that line of thought is not even close enough to your brain. It's just an impossible consideration. So I would borrow my mom's typewriter when I was about 9 or 10 and write sketches, write fake parody commercials. And
you're writing, this is fifth grade or when?
Yeah, that would be like sixth grade. Yeah. I think I shared in the book that some teachers would have me do, I did a series of sketches about different historic things and I got big laughs, Al. I mean, they were really funny.
You know, I wrote something very early about, it was a Civil War sketch.
Yeah.
It was when I was really young. What happened was the boys were on the playground. We come back. The girls, we got a surprise for you. We're going down the AV room. The girls do a show. It's really corny. I get the boys together and we do a parody of their show and make them cry. And then Mrs. Morrison goes like, why don't we do a show together for the parents? And Alan can write it. I was Alan. And I did a Civil War sketch.
Wow.
And it was set in a Civil War first aid tent, like a Red Cross tent. And the girls were the, you know, the nurses. And the one joke I remember that I wrote was that they hear about Lincoln getting assassinated over the radio. And it was an anachronism yeah. joke. And it didn't get a laugh. And I remember thinking, I think I set this up wrong.
Oh, my God. That is so cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool. Is
yeah.
there anything that you can connect that to? Like, did you watch TV and think about writing or?
God, yes. I love comedy. Yeah. You loved comedy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why you did
absolutely.
It.
I mean, you got to know how important you were to that, you and Tom.
Well, you don't mention me that much in the book.
I do mention you, and I think I can't wait to hear what I was a little concerned what you'd say.
It sounds like the first time we meet, you pitch something, and I'm an asshole.
Yes.
I'm going, why?
Why? What do you mean, why? It's a comedy show. It's a comedy bit. But in the end, you saved my ass, too, because...
How did I save your ass?
Well, because it was about the third week I was there, and I was already mm-hmm. struggling really hard. And I was, you know, socially awkward as I just am, but I was for a long time. And you let me help you with that sketch. I hope I remember it correctly. It's the one where Phil's walking through the subway as the homeless guy. Then he's the theater guy, and
oh yeah, yeah, he's begging on the subway. He's a homeless guy begging on the subway, and then he comes back again and. Now he's a member of a theater troupe that's fundraising for their theater troupe. He's not a homeless guy who's playing one in the last pass through the subway. And then he comes back several times, always asking for money.
It's a great sketch. Let me just say what happened was you and Tom had written it, but it was mostly you. It was people passing through the subway. I'm a homeless guy. We're doing a play, and it was like I said, it should just be the same guy or something like that. And then it's one guy, and he keeps changing his story. And then you put my name on the sketch, and then Jim Downey said to you, when he saw the sketch, and it was a good sketch, it played well in the show, he said, Al, did Odenkirk really help, or are you just giving him a handout here? And you said, no, no, he helped. He made that sketch work. And that was huge for me. Huge.
We wrote some stuff together, and I also remember, like, Love Toilet.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Love Toilet? Love Toilet,
yeah. It's a great sketch. And you and I was talking to people about comedy sketches, and I learned so much from Robert Smigel.
Oh, my God. And you knew Robert in Chicago,
but I learned a lot from you because you just knew how to write a sketch, really a strong sketch that would work on the show. And you could write sort of across the different genres, too. So I learned a lot from just being around you.
Well, thanks. Now, you wrote probably one of the most classic sketches, which was Farley as Matt Foley.
Yeah.
Motivational speaker.
Which I wrote in my third year at SNL. So it was, I had 3 years of a lot I'd learned under my belt by then.
You write about in the book about your first interview with Lorne.
Yeah.
That was crazy what you did.
I know. It's so stupid.
tell the folks, well, would you, Bob? Tell the folks.
I had such issues with authority. You know, and poor Lorne. Poor Lorne caught the brunt of it. But I really did. And I'm a waiter. I'm not even a waiter. Al, I'm not even a waiter yet. I'm still taking, they don't even trust me to take orders. I just bring food to the table. Lorne, well, Robert tells me you write sketches. What do you like? And then I go, well, I like Python, you know, kind of like SCTV. Not so into this show. Don't think Saturday Night Live is very good. Oh, interesting. Interesting. Well, do you want to write sketches on this show? You know, Lorne, I don't think it's going in the right direction. I don't know if I want to. I don't think I would, actually. I really, truly walked in thinking, he doesn't want me to kiss his ass. This guy must get his ass kissed every day, all day long. He wants to hear a cold, hard realist tell him, you know, the truth.
You might have overdone it.
I did. I promise you I did. I can't believe I got hired. Even when I walked out of the room, I was like, you handled that wrong. That was so wrong. And then later, you know, Mike Myers had a meeting at Bonnie and Terry Turner met at the same time. And I think Mike did. One of them I talked to later and said, you know, I kind of treated Lorne. I was very critical of the show. What did you do? And then they said, I think it was Mike. He goes, oh, I told him it was all I wanted to do my whole life.
That's the right answer to the question.
You say it. You know, I do think Lorne appreciated a little bit that I was a comedy snob and that, you know, he loved Python too a lot.
Oh, I got a story to tell you about Python. So the first year of the show, I think even before the show started, you know, we all went to the Pythons were on Broadway. Uh-huh. And so we're invited to the party afterwards. And I go up to Cleese and I said, you're my favorite. And he goes, oh, really? Tell him. And he points to Eric.
Oh, God, that's great.
He did it hilariously, yes, too.
It's wonderful.
Okay, let's talk about, God, there's so much to talk about in this book. This book is so rich. Here are some of the things I want to talk about, okay?
Yeah.
Del Close.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Bob and Ray.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the credibility gap.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Mike McKean.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Nobody, of course. Okay. I want to talk about Saul, of course. Yeah. Breaking Bad, yeah. of course.
How about my heart attack?
How about your heart attack? Well, let's
the book is, yeah. You know, I didn't, you know.
You didn't do the heart attack.
No,
in the book.
I didn't, because I wanted it to be a version of that conversation I had with Del, where Del rambled about his career.
And let's tell who Del is.
Yeah.
Tell
so him who Del Close is. Was a mercurial figure from the theater of the 1960s and 70s. He was part of the Compass Players when they were in St. Louis with Mike Nichols and Elaine May and Severn Darden. And he was part of the committee in San Francisco. And he was an actor, teacher, and director of improvisation at Second City for most of his career. And I bumped into him on the street. I didn't know what he looked like. I barely knew his name. And by happenstance, when I was strongly considering going into show business, hoping, wishing I could find a way in or understand a way in, I bumped into him in a bookstore in Chicago. And I said, "Are you Del Close?" I had remembered his name from the program at Second City and also from the Saturday Night Live credits where he'd spent a year or two as the acting coach when they were trying to develop a certain degree of camaraderie amongst this cast that they couldn't get to gel. It was Eddie Murphy, Joe Piscopo.
Okay. That was during the Ebersol.
Yeah. And they brought Del in to do theater games and shit with people. Some people were into it. Some didn't participate. Del, by the way, loved Eddie Murphy and thought Joe Piscopo was kind of funny, but didn't love him. But he loved all the other guys who were, you know, actors, sketch type actors, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and whoever else was on in those years. And so Del had just quit that job at SNL. I had seen his name on the credits. I run into him in the street. I say, "Are you Del Close?" And I have my little recorder with me. I go, "I'm here for my college radio station. Can I interview you?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd love to talk. I just quit cocaine. I just quit heroin. I just quit Second City. And I would love to talk about what's next for me." And so we went to his little shithole Hobbit apartment. And he rambled for 2.5 hours, most of which I still have on cassette.
Yeah, you quote from it freely, long passages. But everyone should know this guy's a god in improv.
But at the time, he wasn't. And by the way, Al, at the time, he was 49 years old. And I would have guessed at the time, I would have thought he was 60, at least 65, maybe. And that's, of course, being
the heroin and cocaine. And
yeah. I was 21,
do that too.
But also he did all these drugs. So he talked and I walked out of his apartment 2 hours later and thought, "I'm going to do this, man. I'm going to try. This could be the greatest career ever to be in." Because I don't know what it was. It was about his energy. You know what else, Al? I was excited about, I'd never met someone his age who was talking excitedly about what they were going to do next week.
Well, your dad certainly didn't.
No, but you know what I mean. Guys back then, once they were 40, 50 years old, it was golf and, I don't know, dragging your ass around, getting the shit done and hoping to retire as soon as you could. And so it was just amazing to meet somebody who was like, "I'm doing a theater show next week, and I don't know what it's going to be, but we're going to have monologues. We're going to use the newspaper." Like, what are you? You know, you seem like you're my age. And I loved that energy. And I felt like I don't have to be a success, a massive success, to be happy pursuing this career. I could do the kinds of offbeat things that he had done, and that would be sounded pretty wonderful to me. And also, I knew I wasn't going to do drugs like that because I just don't like them that much.
Speaking of Farley.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You worked with him in Chicago.
Yeah.
And just the funniest.
Yeah.
Most magnetic,
lovable,
just could make the audience laugh at will.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about him going up and down with drugs and stuff. And I went through that with him and he tried. He really tried a lot. But he was in halfway houses. He went to rehabs. He had periods where he did it. And it was just so unbelievably such a waste.
Yeah,
of course. Of that, I know that you are not happy with the Chippendale sketch, which Downey wrote.
Yeah, no, I really don't like it, and I think it was a bad thing that it happened. I don't think I'm alone. I think Chris Rock feels the same way, because Al, no matter what you say about the construction of the sketch or what the core joke of it was, the truth is, that audience responded in a huge way, both because of the humor, but it was amplified by Chris's physique, which was shocking. And Chris knew it. And, you know, I feel like I can see it in his eyes. And some part of him, and you know, he walked around saying, "Fatty fall down, retarded," fall down, calling himself retarded. He did that all the time, every day. And to me, that moment was him saying, "They laugh at me because I'm a fuck up, mess, fat disaster." And he wanted that laughter so bad. And especially at that moment, that was his first big sketch on the show. And that is why the response was as big as it was. It was supercharged by that shock and awe, which he'd gotten before. He did it at Second City too in various forms. You know, he would take his shirt off, but it just reinforced in him, that's why they're laughing at me. That's my value to the world, is this big, obnoxious, you know, a kind of appalling physique. And it just broke my heart. And I just think it just played to Chris's worst instincts about himself. And I know there was a great joke in that sketch. There's a great joke, of course. It's funny that the judges can't decide who's a better dancer or why they like Patrick Swayze more.
This is the part of the job I hate, was Mike Myers' line.
Yeah.
Because they had to choose between him
and line. Swayze. Great, even a great, bottom line, a great sketch, but maybe Jim didn't recognize it, but he's a pretty goddamn smart guy. Maybe he didn't know Chris well enough yet, but for people who knew him, I feel like it was not good.
But they also, he was so coordinated. Yeah. I mean,
he's a great dancer.
Graceful. And that was part of it too. And also his attitude in it.
Yeah, but Al, look, you know, I just think it's a disagreement. I mean, I love those guys, and maybe this is me. Maybe I'm projecting my feelings, but I feel like, you know, Chris walked around saying that stuff about himself, and that's my feeling, is it maybe reinforce that in a bad way.
Well, let's talk about you.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, the book is kind of about
troublesome,
you.
Cantankerous, hard to read.
Yeah. One thing in the book that really made me laugh is when you describe your dad's job. What your dad's job was?
He made business forms.
And I think you say in the book something like, say that again to yourself, and then you'll be in my thrall or something.
Yeah. I mean, now you are asleep, and you will do my bidding.
He made business forms. There's nothing. And he was not a happy guy, it sounds like. And
no, I think he was, I wish I could tell you more about him, but I didn't. I tried to get to know him. I really did. When I was 22, I got a phone call that he was dying of cancer and we should come see him. And so my brother and I drove down to Indianapolis where he was staying with his parents. And I thought, this is a great opportunity. I very clearly, consciously said to myself, this is my chance. I'm going to say hi to him. I'm going to talk to him, and I'm going to connect with him. And, you know, I knew he was a funny guy. He made wisecracks. He loved barroom jokes, and he didn't love the kind of humor I love, but he did like to laugh, like jokes and stuff. But man, I tell you, I went, forget it. It's not happening. This guy was laying in bed talking about somebody else's car that was better than his, and somebody who got a job that they didn't deserve, and why didn't he get it?
Resentment, it sounds like.
I don't understand it. Who goes through life doing that math? You know, it's just was crazy. I was just sitting there going, who gives a shit? By the way, you're dying of cancer.
Okay, happy. Okay, now we're happy. Let's go happy.
Yeah, but your podcast doesn't need to be happy. It can be.
No, we call ourselves the Happy Podcast. let's talk about some of the influences that you have. But the credibility gap, and Mike McKean,
yeah,
who plays your brother in Better Call Saul, who's brilliant in it.
Yeah.
Brilliant in it. And by the way, I love the show. I love it.
You're so
I love
great.
It. Franny, thank you. Franny and I binge watched it again during the pandemic.
Wow.
And Ray is wonderful. Everybody is wonderful. But Mike, wow.
Wow.
And he came from the Credibility Gap, which was, and he was Lenny and Squiggy. I can't remember if he was Lenny or Squiggy with Dave Lander. And the Credibility Gap had Harry Shearer in it too.
Yes.
You know, they did a Who's On First. You write about somebody doing a Who's On First.
Yes. Yeah, Stephen Leo's Who's On First, but they did a great Who's On First. The Credibility Gap did. It was a lineup for a 3-day like Woodstock festival.
Yeah. And it was the Who.
The Guess Who.
And Yes.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
And it was it was just perfect. And you're a big Bob and Ray fan.
Yeah, and we should talk about Bob and Ray.
I try to get my listeners to really pay attention to Bob and Ray.
I wish their stuff was more accessible. I don't know why it's not on Spotify or something.
It's on YouTube.
Oh,
you can go to stuff on YouTube.
Okay,
not the radio stuff, but some of it is. Some of it is radio.
Brilliant stuff. And you love them too, huh? How did you hear them, Al?
You know what? I heard them the same way you heard them, which is a friend of mine had a tape of them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I did.
And so you and I had the exact same experience, which is we didn't grow up. We didn't grow up in New York where they were on radio.
Yeah.
We had the exact same. Matt Newman played them for me and Tom.
Wow. Do you remember the Bob and Ray bit where the guy is swimming across the country? And he's got a semi-truck filled with water, and for every length of the truck that the truck drives, he swims one lap of the truck as it drives across the country. They just did some just brilliant, silly, and dry, just dry as hell stuff. It's just the best.
Now, Smigel. Let's talk Smigel.
Yeah, Robert Smigel is one of the great comedy writers of the era.
And you know what's great is that both you and he always wanted to be a sketch writer. You know, and I, Tom and I were doing a movie in Chicago.
Yeah.
And we went to see his show. And what was the name of that group?
All You Can Eat was the show. Robert Smigel and a group of funny sketch performers got together and did a show that was mostly scripted by Robert Smigel. He wrote most of the sketches, even if some other people maybe had the idea. Robert put them into words and into script and constructed them. And it was such a hit that it played for a year and a half at the theater building and did really well. And one of the actors in that show was Dave Reynolds, and you and Tom had written a movie and were directing it called Just Another Saturday Night. Just Another Saturday Night. And you cast Dave in one of the leads. It was kind of an ensemble piece, right?
Right.
And because Dave had to go shoot your movie, being a friend of Robert's, I got to fill in for Dave in the sketch show for probably 5 weeks, which was a lot of good money for me. Thank you, Al.
It also was the key to your career.
It was, because I got to know Robert even better. And then you guys came because you've gotten to know Dave Reynolds and you wanted to, and he had told you about this great sketch show he was in. And you guys came and watched All You Can Eat. I wasn't in it. Dave was in it that night. And then you said, "Who wrote this shit?" It's great.
Exactly right.
And you met Robert. And then the next year, you and Tom were executive producers of Saturday Night Live. We're
producers.
Warren
was always.
Exactly. Okay, thank you. And and you hired Robert as a writer. And because Robert got hired as a writer, over the next 2.5 years, I was able to contribute over the phone and, you know, continue getting to know Robert, and he was seeing my work as I was writing.
You know what's impressive about that group, and well, about Robert, really. So Tom and I watched the show, and we just, of course, we go like, "Who wrote this? You know, who wrote this stuff?"
Yeah.
And they won't say, and Robert won't say.
I know.
And I think we went to see it again, and I just figured out it was Robert.
I remember because I talked to Robert about this and he said, oh, I didn't write everything. I didn't. This idea was, you know, Hughes and this idea. And it's like,
well, not everything in it was great.
No, but it was
really good, but
damn good. I mean, for a bunch of kids putting on a show, to make a show that runs like that one did. And I can't even remember some of the sketches that they were just pretty well done. And Robert clearly oversaw the writing. But listen, I owe you for my whole career, as you can see.
No, that's not true.
It's true.
Well, I did tell Vince Gilligan about you.
You did tell Vince Gilligan about this idea about a chemistry teacher who has to make meth.
Well, Smigel, people should know, I think they know him as Triumph, the insult comic right. dog. I mean, he's the behind that, but he's behind so much. Da Bears, he's behind yeah. all this, is a brilliant writer, one of the stalwarts at the show, and a perfectionist and hilarious. So it's good that you knew Robert there. So I credit Robert more than us. We just saw it. We figured out Robert. That's what we did on Mr. Show.
Yeah.
With David Cross.
Yeah.
You guys were doing stuff that was very different in sensibility, which is why it was a cult hit.
Yeah. I mean, we did some pretty crazy stuff. We did some sketches that are pretty traditional sketches. Like Hunger Strike or Lie Detector or The Audition is one that people love to do in their.
Well, The Audition is a classic and it's tradition. That feels like a very David Cross kind of conceptual.
It was written by Dino Stamatopoulos, who you might know.
Oh, okay.
Great writer. You know, when I think of that show, we certainly had fun and we indulged our every whim, but my favorite thing about the show were the solid good sketches we did that are kind of classic construction sketches, not the stuff where we wandered around being indulgent, because that stuff is kind of easy to do. I'm really proud of the probably about 10 or 12 sketches that are just great ones. And one of them is the story of Everest. Have you ever seen that one?
No.
Oh, you'd love it. Okay, go on YouTube and watch The Story of Everest.
Okay, I just want to interrupt the conversation here. I did that. I went on YouTube. I got the Story of Everest. It's hilarious. It is a classic. It is so funny. Do yourself a favor after you're done with this podcast. Don't stop listening to this podcast, for God's sakes. But then go to YouTube and get The Story of Everest. You'll be glad you did. Okay, we're going to take a quick break now, and we'll be right back with Bob Odenkirk.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Well, you did The Shambling Show.
Yeah.
Larry Sanders. Yeah. You played his. Were you a network exec or an agent?
I was an agent. I was Ari Emanuel, essentially.
Yeah.
I was just doing my impersonation of Ari.
And it's so funny that
when you were called about Breaking Bad, you hadn't seen it, right?
No, I hadn't. I didn't watch it until I was on the plane. I had a DVD of it, and I watched about maybe 15 minutes of it. I kind of knew it was a drama. Well, that's all I knew. Well, I mean, it wasn't a hit.
That's all you need to know.
The show wasn't a hit.
It wasn't. And was it the first season or second? First.
It was the second season.
Second.
The first season was abbreviated because of the writer's strike.
Oh, that's right.
And as a result, not many people had seen it. And the one friend that I called about it raved about it, said it's the best show on TV. You have to do that show. But nobody else, I think I knew, had ever even seen it.
I love that. Okay, so you're going to shoot for the first time, and Saul has lots of lines.
Yeah.
And you're used to comedy, I guess. I think in comedy sketches, you have to learn your lines, but you're used to sort of like, okay, it changes. Lines.
Yeah,
change.
I'm used to a lot of freedom with like punch up the lines, say what you want that's funny, and shift it around all you want, you know? And I'm also used to things getting cut down, Al. You know, comedy, there are some funny comic monologues, but most of the time, it's kind of a faster paced dialogue. It pops back and forth between characters, and you don't sit on one person for six lines or more. And this thing that I got from Breaking Bad was Saul Goodman talking and talking and talking.
And you sort of didn't bother to learn your lines at first.
No, I didn't learn my lines for the first week. I didn't bother. I was certain.
Oh, okay.
I was certain that they were going to change that to just cut those monologues down to two lines. So I didn't learn it. I get there on Friday. I have the weekend. The shoot is on like Tuesday. I get the blue pages, which is like, I don't know, the second rewrite or the third. And it's really where you should start. You should know your lines then. And nothing has changed. One word has been altered. And I'm like, oh, shit. I have 2 days, but I've never done anything like the rambling monologues that Saul did. And so I just dug in, man. I was scared, but I had the time to do it. I just dug in and I did that. I did an impersonation of Robert Evans because, you know, Evans had that kind of cliffhanger. What am I going to say next? You have no idea. and it was kind of fun to listen to. You're like, wow, what is he going to say next? It's just crazy, right? Was it the best thing that ever happened to me or the worst? It was both. You know, and I just did that just to kind of prep, just to keep myself entertained. But I also thought it was kind of fun to find like a different rhythm and try to make those monologues fun to listen to.
You kind of write about, you know, acting and being in the moment you wrote the book now. So you've been doing how many years of Saul? How many seasons?
It's like 13 years ago that I started playing that character. We finished shooting the series a week ago today.
So how's it end?
I can't tell you anything.
Okay. Of course you can't.
Jeez, here's what I'll tell you, Al. The two shows, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, have never been so intertwined.
Oh, good.
That's all.
I was hoping that because that it's bringing it up to date, right? That's the whole point. It's a backstory.
Well, you can, the way it works is basically the writers have their choice of how much they want to tie these two shows together. And in the last season, I was very surprised at how they dug in on that and they really bound them together. And it's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, obviously, because...
Yeah, I think when you watch the last season of Saul, if you watch it, and I hope you will, you'll probably want to watch Breaking Bad as soon as it's done.
Well, that's exciting. I've been waiting.
Yeah.
Well, those standard
COVID held us up, and then I had a heart attack, and that took me out for 5 weeks.
Oh, so let's talk about the heart attack just a little bit.
Yeah.
So you're fine. You're fine.
Wait, Al, it goes like this. It goes, you're fine. You're fine. You're dead. then you're fine again.
Yeah, you were. Your kind of heart stopped or something, right?
Well, look. yes, I had a full-on heart attack. I was very lucky because we were in the studio and we had walked to the far side of the studio. It was COVID, so COVID protocols kept everyone far from each other, which might have been dangerous, but it would have been far more dangerous if we'd been on location or if I'd gone to my trailer. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be talking to you. There'd be no season because I would have died. So I had a heart attack, but Racy Horn and Patrick Fabian were right there at their, you know, spots nearby. And they saw me go down. They ran right over to me. They started yelling because Ray said I turned blue right away. Like within seconds, I was turning blue and gray. They started screaming. People were very far away because it's a huge modern studio. And they actually thought people were laughing or they couldn't tell what that yelling was. But I think it was pretty intense. And then the medic came over, and I'll just say it was his first day as a medic. And he lost his shit a little bit. His jaw dropped and he kind of froze. Ray and Patrick continued to yell and slap me and shit. And eventually some of the crew wandered over, not too long, and they went and got Rosa Estrada and Angie Meyer, who was the AD. And Rosa Estrada was a medic. She'd served a tour with the Army, and she ran out from her office and started CPR. Total pro, crazy pro, did it just right. She's done it before. And she also had an AED in her car. So Angie Meyer took over while she ran to her car after about 10 minutes and got the AED.
What's an AED?
AED is a defibrillator that you can, you know, it's like a simple one that you can keep in your car. You can have it at your house. They have them.
Oh, yeah. I have one.
Do you?
No.
Well, a lot of people
didn't know what it was.
It's really easy to use, and it's a defibrillator.
Okay.
And by the way, I was told later the safest place to have a heart attack is a casino or a airport because they have AEDs everywhere. Anyway,
okay. So
plan your next heart attack
for
Morongo Casino. anyway, she jacked me up. It took me 3 shots to come back to a steady rhythm, which is a lot. And if anything was the most scary point, it was after the second defibrillation that didn't work. People were pretty sure it was over. So luckily the third one worked. And the next morning I had this surgery through my wrist to put in 2 stents. So, you know, that's it.
And you're good.
I am.
Now, who told you? Did any of your friends ever tell you that maybe they're working you too hard?
Yeah. Yeah, some friends did. I think maybe you said something.
Yeah, and Robert.
Robert, you know how showbiz works. They get the money.
I know, but you were doing like what?
14-hour days.
First of all, you're
14-hour
days, and you're the star. There's no show if you say, guys, we're doing 12-hour days.
Yeah. I know. And you made this point to me, and I thank you for it. You and Robert did me a great service by giving me the same lecture on 2 different phone calls with great emphasis and gusto and certainty. And it meant a lot to hear it. It helped me a lot. Because as I was coming back, I wasn't sure how to approach the job, and there was talk about – I was still in a pretty – weakened state for a couple months, Al. I couldn't have done more than 12 hours. Thank God we landed on that and made it a sure thing.
And the rest of the crew just was so happy that you did that, right?
They really were. They really were. They were all thankful that there was a reason to call the day after 12 hours. I mean, oftentimes they had to continue with other actors and other scenes, but it did limit what the whole crew could do most days. And they were all very appreciative, you know, but this is how this business works. You know, you get the money for a movie or TV show, and then you get to the set, and then you just try to shoot until you're done. And whatever that means, you go as late as you can. And
I know, but this is a series that you're the star of.
Yeah. Well, you and Robert made the point to me when this 12-hour limit was in play, and I was like, I don't know. I don't want to hold up the show, and I don't want to limit people who are willing to do 16 hours. I mean, they're willing to do anything. They're so happy to be in show business. And you said, what the fuck is your problem? You fucking died. Take care of yourself. And you guys were right.
I want to talk about Nobody.
Yeah.
Are you going to do the sequel?
Oh, yeah, I want to. I mean, we're writing it right now. I say we.
Nobody was the number one movie in the country for quite a while, and it's great.
It was the number one streamer of the year.
It's so fabulous, that movie. I mean, it's so funny to go from sketch writer, comedian, I mean, you know, a sketch player, to a bit, you know, a small part on Larry Sanders.
Yeah.
To Saul on Breaking Bad, to having the whole Better Call Saul show built around you. But then to be, I think I called you after I don't even think I had seen it yet. I saw the trailer, but I knew how successful it was already, and said, you should just do a talk show and say you're only doing action movies. It's so great.
Al, thank you, man. Thank you. It was such a crazy dream to do it. It was like,
hey, everybody listens to this. Just stream this thing and you'll thank me. And then listen to the podcast again. Man.
Thank you.
Let's see. Oh, Jeremy Irons. You got to tell us Jeremy Irons stories. He hosted the show.
He's hosting the show. And he's a great actor. He
SNL.
And I'm supposed to write the monologue with Rob Schneider, I believe. Yeah. And we have an idea, and that's its own fight, me and Schneider, but or anybody in Schneider. And
I wrote stuff with him where we had a great time.
Yes, good. So we write this monologue, and it's just about, he's up for an Oscar, and it's just about the Oscar, and I can't remember what it is. It's just about the Oscar. And it's like smart aleck shit. And there's not a lot to it. So we go down, we show it to him. He reads it. He's getting pressured. I mean, it's like, I think it's Saturday. It might be Friday, but I think it's Saturday. He's got to do it in just a few hours. And he gets so mad at me. And I have a little recorder that I was using to record my ideas and stuff. And I press record as he starts to get mad at me. And I recorded him yelling at me, and he goes on this rant where he's like, I don't know. What is it, Mr. Irons? Well, it's just that, I mean, I'm an actor, I can dance, I can sing, I can do gymnastics, I'm a juggler, I can do monologues, and you have me doing this? This is what you want me to do? He's so mad. And he's right. He's kind of right. He can do a lot of cool shit, and we have him making stupid wisecracks about wanting to win an Oscar or something. I don't know.
Yeah, he was difficult. I mean, Downey had written a brilliant piece with him and Farley. He's a former like banker, like enormously rich banker from London, who's disgraced, and he has to go like to Nebraska and manage a Burger King or something like that. and he's interviewing Farley for a job. You know, do you have a car? Can you, you know? But it's just a monologue of him saying what he used to be, and just hating this.
Oh,
and he just goes to Jim like, It's one joke, isn't it? It's just one joke.
Oh. Some of the best sketches are one joke.
I know. This was a fucking brilliant sketch.
Yeah.
And it was Jim Down. I mean, I'm not saying
Jim
wrote some pieces that died, but we all did. But this one was hilarious.
Wait, you have to tell me, Al, you have to tell the whole world about the Steven Seagal sketch real quick. The last one, the one where he ends up by looking into camera and saying, "That's what you get for messing with Mother Nature," or something.
If anyone ever asked me who is the worst host ever, there's no question.
Yeah.
It's Steven Seagal. Oh, my God. You know, he was so bad. I don't know if you know this story. So, then, like, 2 weeks later, we had Nicolas Cage. And he's had done this movie, Moonstruck, I think, with Cher.
Yeah.
And his monologue, he starts just talking about how great it was working with Cher. And he just talks about her body parts and stuff. And Davey Wilson, you know, over the thing goes, you know, Nick, could you, you know, come, Lauren wants to talk to you. And he goes, Lauren goes like, why are you talking about her? Well, they're just so great. He goes, well, you know, you're Sofia Coppola's cousin, what if someone talked about, you know, her like that? And he goes, oh, God, you're right. Oh, and he does that kind of thing. And then he goes, you must think I'm the worst host that ever hosted the show. And Lauren just goes, no, that would be Steven Seagal. and then about 2 weeks later, I'm on The Tonight Show. Jay's hosting. And it's like me and the Ramones. And I'm going, that's not a Tonight Show. And when I get there, it's Seagal is the big guest. And then so I'm the second guest. I get there on the chair. And during a break, after my first segment, he leans over to me and goes like, why did Lauren say that about me?
Oh, jeez.
And I kind of freeze. I don't know what to say. And Jay just leans over and goes, oh, you know, the joke is that, you know, you're such a big star. And, you know, wouldn't make any sense not to make fun of a big, you know, it has to be the biggest star ever.
Oh, my God. And
also, you're so tough. I mean, you do these action movies. So that's the funny thing, too. And Seagal's going, oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Jay is great right there. He's a hero.
Oh, my God. He saved my ass.
Perfect. Really well done.
And then right after that, and then he's going, oh, all right. Okay, we're back.
That's a great one, man. I love that Leno's the hero.
Oh, he was the hero. Yeah, I'm just going like,
that's a brilliant.
Okay, I want to ask you about when you were in The Post with David.
Yeah.
And Spielberg's directing this movie.
Yeah.
And you and David Cross are in it, and who are, you know, the co-stars and writers, et cetera, of a cult thing that Spielberg doesn't know. And so, and you don't tell him, right?
No, because we don't.
Because you want to be in the Spielberg movie and he might freak out.
Yeah.
So then, but about 2/3 of the way through the movie, someone goes like, wow, it's Bob and Dave.
Exactly.
And he figures it out and he goes, and he says, do I have a problem?
Yeah. That's right.
Oh, boy.
We were, not only were we in it together, but he kept putting us next to each other. And we, and so.
He had a wig. David had a wig.
Yeah, but we looked at each other and we would, every time he would go, David, go stand there, Bob. Go stand there. You guys are walking through. Bob, go walk next to David. And we'd be like, all right, I think he's a fan of the show. I think he just wants a Mr. Show reunion in his movie. Okay, well, I don't want to say it, but that seems like what's happening. So then Zach Penn was there, and he's a screenwriter who loves Mr. Show and friends of ours, and he had written Ready Player One, and they were working on it at the time as well as Spielberg doing The Post at the same time. And Zach was the one who, behind the camera, Spielberg once again puts us together. And you said we were 2/3. We had finished almost all the major group scenes. We were done. We had one, maybe one more scene. And he does this thing again where he goes, David, go stand closer to Bob. And Zach out loud goes, oh my God, Bob and David. And that's when what you just said happens. Spielberg goes, what are you talking about? And he goes, they had a show, HBO, Bob and David, Mr. Show. They were on the show. It's the greatest. It's a funny sketch show. And then Spielberg goes, oh, do I have a problem? And then Zach said, I immediately told him, no, no, don't worry. It's a cult hit. Nobody knows it.
We got to go, but I want to thank you for all your help when I was running for the Senate.
Well, I got to thank you for all your help. And I think I mentioned in the book that you helped me, and I mean it, Al. And so thank you for everything and your support all these years.
And congratulations, Jesus Christ. Look at your career. It's fab. I mean, and boy, did you earn it. If you'll see in the book of you're going through periods, like really long periods where nothing works, nothing happens.
Yep.
So I'm so happy you. And I'm looking forward to the next Nobody.
Thanks, man.
And I'm looking forward to this season of Saul.
Oh, I can't wait for people to see it, Al. It's going to be great. I really love what they wrote. It was so good. I can't wait.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.